Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Security is intense around the Brooklyn Federal Courthouse for the arraignment today of terror plot suspect Najibullah Zazi. The charge is conspiracy to use homemade bombs on targets inside the United States, and officials believe they were likely here in New York, those targets. At least three other suspects are still being sought, however, and that raises the issue of whether the NYPD may have bungled the investigation by letting it become public too early, to the dismay of the FBI. An op-ed in yesterday's New York Times calls the FBI and the NYPD the Hatfields and the McCoys of counterterrorism, but Mayor Bloomberg is having none of that.
The cooperation between the two agencies, who work very well together, resulted in the detention and indictment today of people who were going to kill a lot of people in this country, or at least that's the allegation.
So let's talk about these things with James Gordon Meek, Daily News senior correspondent, covering security, among other issues, and Chris Dickey, usually Newsweek's Paris bureau chief, but also author of the book, Securing the City, Inside America's Best Counterterror Force, the NYPD. He also had a piece on Newsweek.com over the weekend about this. Welcome back, both of you. Good morning.
Always a pleasure.
Good morning.
James, all the cameras are on the spectacle of Zazi's arraignment today, but who are these suspects still at large, as far as anybody knows?
Oh, it's a fantastic question. I mean, we've been reporting at the Daily News for quite some time that the FBI and NYPD as well as the Joint Terrorism Task Force, in which they both participate in New York, have had quite a few people under surveillance, both in New York and in Denver, Colorado, where Najibullah Zazi, who is going to be appearing in court today, was arrested, where he's been living for a number of months, and possibly other places as well. It's not clear to us exactly why they haven't made more arrests other than really this one principal guy, because the other people arrested are not really viewed as being part of the plot necessarily, although, again, the FBI is still running down leads, but it may well be that they're still trying to surveil some of these folks, and it may well be that they just don't feel they have a criminal case that they can make against them. It's more of an intelligence case, which it's harder to bring into a court of law, But yeah, they've definitely been watching quite a few people.
James, what's that distinction between a criminal case and an intelligence case?
Well, you may have intelligence on some suspects that suggest that they are terrorists or they're connected to terrorists, but that may not be enough to bring a criminal indictment in a federal court. The Patriot Act, to some degree, loosened that standard, you know, a number of years ago after 9/11, to make it easier for the feds to use intelligence, particularly obtained from Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act warrants, and that the surveillance and searches that they can do when they get those FISA warrants from a secret court in Washington. But still, you know, there are occasions when you have intel, and this actually goes to the issue at Guantanamo Bay, where there are some people who were tortured, and the evidence against them is highly classified intelligence, and it's not necessarily something they feel comfortable about bringing in a civilian court. So you may have that issue at play here in this case, where you have some folks where the evidence just isn't hard enough yet, and they are trying to bring forward a case.
And Chris Dickey, same question. Before we even get to the issue of competition between the NYPD and the FBI, or if the NYPD made some mistakes here, as far as you know, who are these suspects still at large?
Well, I think the NYPD for a long time has focused on the idea that terrorists, especially homegrown terrorists, tend to be associated with what you call groups of guys. Often they went to the same school together. Sometimes they were on the same teams together. And my guess is that they are focusing on those kinds of individuals. Also, they have records of people who, while in Colorado with Zazi, allegedly went with him to pick up hydrogen peroxide and acetone and other beauty parlor products that also can be used to make bombs. So I think they have a pretty good idea who they're looking at, and I think they're watching him pretty closely.
Did the NYPD blow this investigation?
Well, yeah, in a sense, sure, there was a mistake. But I think to elaborate on what James was saying earlier, you have to look at the whole question of the way intelligence is run in these operations. And What the NYPD decided to do very early on after 9/11 was to focus on prevention, stopping terrorist attacks, not necessarily prosecuting people. So it isn't just a question of an intelligence case or a prosecutable case. There's also intelligence that's gathered in order to disrupt terrorist plots and often to recruit people who are involved in them. All of that's at play in this. The specific mistake, yeah, it was pretty simple. The FBI asked the NYPD Intelligence Division to go out and canvass its sources, which are very good, particularly in that neighborhood of Flushing. And they did, and they just didn't know that one of the guys they were talking to was close to the suspect's father and called him up.
Close to the suspect's father. Tell me about that relationship.
We don't know what the details – I don't know what the details of that relationship are, but we do know that after they showed some pictures to this imam out there in Queens and asked him if he knew these guys, they said – he said, yeah, I know three of the four guys you're showing me, and one of these guys is Najibullah Zazi. It may be that two of the other guys who were unnamed in all this reporting are some of the people they're still looking at. And very soon after that, he called up Zazi's father.
James, does that put a different light on this imam from Queens who was arrested, who had been an informant for the FBI in the past? So is it perhaps less that, if the charges against him are true, less that he was supporting terrorism while, you know, faking being a loyalist with the FBI, and more that he had a kind of personal soft spot for this family?
You know, that's possible, Brian. Let me make 3 points if I can remember all
sure.
of them. One is some suspects may have actually left the country, so bear in mind that possibility. That's why some people may not have been collared yet. Secondly, and I'll get to Afzali, but on the question of whether the NYPD blew it, there's something very interesting here, which is that the FBI, you know, FBI sources I've been talking to have been griping about the NYPD, you know, basically breathing down this guy's neck, showing his picture around, calling the imam to say if he knew, or going to the imam and saying, do you know this guy? And they feel that sort of blew the tale. There's a philosophical difference here between the FBI wanting to keep a sort of covert surveillance on a guy like Najibullah Zazi as long as possible to learn who all of his co-conspirators are and what they're up to, and NYPD, which feels like once this guy sets foot in New York City, as this fellow did when he drove into the city crossing the George Washington Bridge on September 10th, they felt like they had to put their foot on his throat, and so they did. And they feel they spooked the cell. They scared off any sort of plot. The feds, who have been complaining, what's interesting about that is that a federal prosecutor in court on Friday said that the planned attack was supposed to take place on the September 11th anniversary. So the FBI might have wanted to stay on this guy longer, but apparently he was planning to set off bombs on 9/11, which I think in some sense, if that is correct, may vindicate the NYPD's decision to,
yeah.
you know, get on this guy and spook him. And so that's – but as far as Imam Afzali, there's an interesting thing there where Afzali has said, I believe, that he knew Zazi as a child when he was a teenager, and he hadn't seen him in years, and he didn't know him. And yet he gets on the phone with him after the father puts him in touch with Najibullah, and he asks Najibullah, when was the last time you were in Pakistan? And he asks him, he says, oh, your car was towed. He said, was there any evidence in the car? I mean, I don't know, Brian, do you ask your friends when their cars get towed, hey, did you have any evidence in the car?
That's yeah,
kind of
all the time.
It's a weird question, you know, you got to admit.
Chris? Yeah, I mean, I think if you want to take apart this whole question of the feud between the FBI and the NYPD, I mean, the central figure in it really is David Cohen, who's the head of intelligence for the NYPD and who was 30 years in the CIA and former director of clandestine operations for the CIA. He's sort of the central figure, one of the central figures in my book. And Cohen is normally Mr. Let's follow people, let's not arrest them, let's just see this play out as long as possible. But James is exactly right. When this guy, Najibullah Zazi, arrives in New York, he stopped on the George Washington Bridge. They know that the FBI knows that he's probably been cooking up explosives. He stopped on the George Washington Bridge by a police roadblock, Port Authority police roadblock that the FBI asked them to do. That spooks him. He understands after that he's being watched, that there's a problem. And then everybody's pulling out the stops to find out everything they can, because it's not only the 9/11 anniversary coming up. President Obama was going to be in town on that Monday. So you got really have a sort of a, it's like 24 hours. It's like a ticking time bomb scenario. How are you going to unravel this case? And in that environment, did they ask this imam if he knew these guys? Sure they did. He was not a paid informant. He was just somebody they would go to corroborate stuff. He had been cooperating with the police for a long time. It's not unusual that they would ask him a question.
My guests on WNYC, Chris Dickey, Newsweek's Paris bureau chief in real life, but also the author of the book Securing the City, Inside America's Best Counterterror Force, the NYPD, and James Gordon Meek, covering the alleged terror plot for the Daily News. We can get a few phone calls or web comments in. If you want to ask a question or say something about this, particularly the issues that we're focusing on, what about the suspects still at large? Did the NYPD blow this in any way? And is competition between the FBI and NYPD a debilitating factor here? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show, and we have a call right now from Gary in Queens. Gary, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi. Specific question, what alerted the authorities to these particular people? But generally, do the authorities look at certain kinds of purchases to try to pick up on possible plots?
Chris Dickey?
The authorities, the U.S. federal government had been following Najibullah Zazi, it appears, for quite some time. He had made two trips to Pakistan, and certainly by the time he came back from the last one last year, they were watching him. They were keeping a very close eye on him. There are a lot of people who go to Pakistan. There are a lot of people who even espouse jihad that are not watched all that closely. But they are watched closely enough, we hope, so that when they start doing overt acts that seem to be the process of bomb-making, like buying acetone and peroxide in large quantities, industrial quantities, then that's the time that law enforcement authorities, whether the NYPD, the feds, whoever, start to really close in on them.
James, it sounds like it might be overblown a little bit as a topic in the press, this competition between the FBI and the NYPD. The framing of the op-ed piece, though, which was by a former NYPD, anti-terrorism official in the Times yesterday, Michael Sheehan. I don't know if he wrote the title, but the Hatfields and McCoys of counterterrorism. It's not that bad.
Well, yeah. Well, yeah.
James, go ahead, and then Chris.
I think it is. I definitely think there are problems. I think the media does get too excited about it. But Chris, look, I don't deal with the NYPD, really. My colleagues in New York do. I deal with the feds primarily in Washington. But Chris, correct me if I'm wrong here, but didn't Ray Kelly, the commissioner of police in New York City, essentially kind of tap Joseph Demarest, the relatively new New York City FBI field office assistant director? I mean, aren't those guys pretty tight?
Yeah, they are. I mean, I was just going to say one of the big issues here is personalities. And when Michael Sheehan was head of the Counterterrorism Bureau, which is different than the Intelligence Division, there were huge, huge fights between the NYPD and the people who were then in charge of the New York field office. And so it really was Hatfield and McCoys. But the situation has evolved and the personalities have changed.
And one of the stories that seems outrageous in the Sheehan piece, he says in one case the FBI and the NYPD had different informants covering the same suspect. Each agency fought for control of the case and questioned the validity of the other's information.
Yeah, there was a lot of that going on, and it's a big, big part of my book, as a matter of fact. And I don't think we should say that there was never any fighting. There was a hell of a lot of fighting between the NYPD and the FBI, and some of it clearly is still going on. But the relationship between Kelly and Cohen and Richard Falkenrath, the head of counterterrorism, and Joe Demarest at the FBI is supposed to be a very, by all accounts mm-hmm. of the people involved, is supposed to be a very good relationship, very positive.
But James, since you cover the feds, the Sheehan piece also says this Zazi case seems to have provided a new opportunity for some in the FBI to settle old scores and perhaps lobby to close the NYPD's counterterrorism unit altogether, especially, he says, as Commissioner Kelly and Mr. Cohen consider their next steps after nearly 8 years in their respective jobs. You think there's anything to that?
Not really. I mean, good luck. I don't think they're going to close the Counterterrorism Bureau. I mean, Janet Napolitano, the Secretary of Homeland Security, praises New York City's counterterrorism and intelligence operations. Everybody else does. It is a model of the world. But at the same time, the FBI remains their big rival on the planet. But bear in mind, there's a difference between the New York FBI, the Washington FBI, the Denver FBI. You know, you got people who are not under Joe Demarest, who are not working hand-in-hand with the NYPD, who are outside that circle within the FBI. They're the ones, I think, who are doing most of the complaining, particularly in Denver. But again, I really think that if the federal prosecutor who went into court last week was correct, and it was a September 11th bombing, what that suggests is if they really wanted to stay on this guy longer than they did, then it sounds like maybe they should have got on him earlier or learned more sooner. Yeah. Because it seemed to, in my mind, have vindicated the NYPD's decision to spook the cell. And, so the internal bickering in politics, there'll be plenty of time for that. Right now, people are racing to make sure that New York City doesn't get blown up again.
Indeed. Martin in Harlem has a question about the case. Martin, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yes, good morning, Brent. Well, a quick question. Just who paid $1.5 million for the imam to get out?
Chris, any idea?
I don't know.
I don't believe that was actually. I believe essentially, if he jumps bail, then somebody has to pay. I think it may have been his relatives put up property. I can't recall exactly.
The Daily News is bond. The Daily News editorial page today, and I realize you're a reporter, not an editorial writer. James says Ray Kelly wants to ring the region with radiation sensors on highways, bridges, and tunnels to detect the presence of pirated nuclear material, but Obama's Homeland Security Department dropped the appropriation. And House Democrats, including Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Majority Leader Steny Hoyer, Majority Whip James Clyburn, and most committee chairmen, all battled to kill the funding. What do you know about that?
What I know about that is, according to officials within the government, that the system doesn't work. so the money that they wanted to put into it was to keep essentially researching and developing, working on it. But it doesn't really work that well. In other words, it can't stop a dirty bomb.
Yeah, it's to pick up radiation from biological or chemical or nuclear agents as they approach the city in a vehicle, right?
Yeah,
Chris,
from nuclear agents.
Nuclear. Biological, they're not going to catch that.
And right,
chemical, that's not radiation.
Either. Yeah. Yeah.
Not a finer example of American technology know-how so far, apparently. So. But I don't want to argue with our editorial board. I mean, they're making a case, and look, they should throw money at something like that. I mean, God, we need it. They ought to make it work. That's the real story, is why doesn't it work after all these years and all this money?
Yeah, I think one of the things to keep in mind, particularly for New Yorkers to keep in mind, is that New York is the number one target in the world for terrorists. I mean, look at the Zazi case. The guy's out in Denver and apparently plotting to hit New York City. And one of the things that I think they're increasingly concerned about is that there are these little sort of incubators of homegrown terrorists around the country in Phoenix or Denver or where have you. But actually, when it comes to picking a target, what are they going to look for? They're going to look to come to the place where they get the most publicity, and that's New York City. So whether it's nuclear detection or intelligence gathering, it's all focused on protecting the city.
A few more minutes with James Gordon Meek, covering the alleged terror plot for the Daily News, and Chris Dickey, author of Securing the City, Inside America's Best Counterterror Force, the NYPD. Chris in Rockaway, you're on WNYC. Hi, Chris.
Yeah, hey, Brian. Good show.
Thank you.
Hey, quick question. Would the guests know whether the authorities are using enhanced interrogation, i.e. torture, against the suspect?
I'm sure they're not.
Why?
Yeah, I don't think they are either. I think that's just not the FBI's way. They like to talk to people. They call it rapport-based interrogation, and it works quite well for them.
Yeah, the FBI, in fact, was instrumental, actually, at some points in exposing the enhanced interrogation techniques used earlier in the decade by the CIA and others.
Absolutely right.
NYPD, do they interrogate terrorism suspects differently from some guy who may have robbed a bank?
Well, one of their advantages is that they have more than 700 people who speak foreign languages, whether Urdu or Pashto or Arabic or Farsi, whatever. So they tend to interrogate them in their own language, and very, very effectively.
But based on what you both have said, it is not clear yet whether this plot has definitively been foiled because of these other people at large. So you don't have quite the famous ticking time bomb scenario. in which people justify torture, but you have suspects at large and some ambiguity as to whether an imminent plot has definitely been disrupted. Is that accurate, James?
I mean, I got to say, this is probably the closest I've ever heard of a ticking bomb scenario, because I've always been pretty skeptical about those, because I've never met anybody who could actually name a single example. But now, this is one you could actually name, because this guy came to New York, and again, they have some information to believe he intended to set off bombs on the day after he arrived.
So what do you do if you're the NYPD or the FBI and trying to get the information about these other at-large suspects, and what do you not do?
Well, in this case, they decided to breathe down the guy's neck and let him know they were onto him and see, you know, sometimes there's great value in that, because when you get onto somebody and they know they're being watched, they know they're being followed, then they take certain actions they might not otherwise out of panic, desperation. That in itself can be a great way to gather intelligence and find out who co-conspirators are, the panicky phone calls to others being an example of that, emails and so forth, where they might not necessarily think their email is being captured, and yet it is, or they're texting somebody, or whatever. If I can raise one thing, though, that makes this case really incredibly unique, and I think Chris would agree with me on this, Zazi is an Afghan Pashtun tribesman. And this is the first time, and I've talked to, you know, all the top experts that I know on Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden and his network. This is the first time anybody can think of, I mean, of an Afghan, much less a Pashtun tribesman, being involved in an external terrorism operation outside of South Asia. This is new territory, at least inside the United States. This is a first. Afghans have never been in the leadership of Al-Qaeda, which is a fundamentally Arab, North African, East African, and Pakistani organization.
That may bring
a whole new element that's even bigger than this case, in a sense.
Is that an argument, Chris Dickey, before we run out of time, for the war or against the war in Afghanistan?
Well, it's an argument that the war can come back home at any moment, and that fighting in Afghanistan may not solve the problem of terrorism here in the United States.
Chris Dickey, usually the Mideast editor and Paris bureau chief for Newsweek, author of Securing the City, Inside America's Best Counterterror Force, the NYPD. James Gordon Meek, covering the alleged terror plot for the Daily News as Ajibullah Zazi gets arraigned in Brooklyn Federal Court today. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, Nomi Prinz calls Tim Geithner Pollyanna. And more from her new book. Stay with us.